everyone tuning in, welcome to Filmmakers Uncut. This is a podcast where we pick the brains of some of the industry's top leaders in filmmaking and photography world. Today we're here with Matt Ardeen. How's it going, Matt?
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for hopping on. Usually we just like to get started with a little introduction. So if you can give our audience a little introduction of yourself, that would be amazing.
Yeah, I work as a gaffer and lighting designer. I do a lot of commercials, feature films, TV, and also broadcast concerts. It's been about 18 years of doing lighting for those various venues.
That's beautiful. And I know you've worked on a lot of huge sets. If you can name like a few of those for us. I know you were recently on some films as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the recent one that's pretty popular right now is Everything Everywhere All at Once. I did that one. And Gaslit, which came out on Starz a couple months ago, did that. And just a buttload of commercials that are running right now. But I think that the big hit that I'm getting a lot of the questions about lately is Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Yeah, for sure. That film definitely had a lot of different lighting techniques in there that, you know, when you look at it, you're like, oh my God, there's so much changes. Was that like one of the hardest films you've done for lighting?
I think so. It's also too that budget realm is a little difficult. Because I've done, I did a movie called like Swiss Army Man, which is the director's previous film, which was really low budget. Like I think we were like $3 million or something, where when you're doing that budget, you don't have the equipment and you don't have the crew. And it's like lower expectations of what can be accomplished, you know? And then Everything Everywhere All at Once, I think that was like 13 to 15 million, which is a weird budget range. Because it's not like 25 million and up where it's like, I get the crew and I get the equipment and like, we're just expected that we have to accomplish this stuff and we have the resources to do so. Cause I've done those movies. Like I did the second Spider-Man sections of that, where it's just like, you can get whatever you want. You need to make sure that everything's good to go. But then like the budget range of EAO of like 13 to 15 million, it's like, hey, here's the equipment, but you don't have a fully staffed department. Accomplish this, and like these are all the crazy things you need to do, and we're shooting this tomorrow, by the way. So I think that was the most difficult part, is trying to achieve everything they needed without having like a fully staffed out department like I normally would on a bigger movie. But the Daniels are very understanding of the budget, and like they have a lot of control of the budget. Like they want the money to be seen on camera, and so they sort of pick and choose where to put the money for various scenes, and they're very much in control of that and working with the producers of making sure that it's going to the right areas and letting everyone know what the most important part of this scene or that scene is, so that we'll make sure that that will show up on camera.
Very cool. And so obviously it was a lot more difficult not having, you know, as many crew members. How'd you guys overcome that situation?
So they planned it out that we shot, I think, 30 days in one building. So like everything to do with the IRS is all one building, all the different hallways, elevators, even the house, the apartment that they live in. We built that in the same building, in the cafeteria of this old office building. They just like built the set and turned it into a little studio. And then we did 5 days in the laundromat, which was a location. And then we did 5 days around downtown Los Angeles, where I think each day was its own location. And then we had a few reshoot days after that. But in those 30 days of being in the one building, it was nice because we knew the next set was just like down the hallway. So it was the only way we were able to accomplish this movie with the budget that we had, was, okay, well, I can break off two people from set to go get tomorrow's set ready because it's just down the hallway. Had it all been separate locations, that wouldn't have happened. We would have needed a full rigging crew. And a rigging crew, if your viewers don't know, is like the other half of the lighting department. So I'll give them like lighting plots and talk with a rigging gaffer typically. And then they're the advanced crew getting the next sets ready and then wrapping the sets behind us. So when we do like normal budget stuff, you know, that's the crew that's setting everything up. And then first unit comes in on the day, me with the electricians and the programmer, and we're bringing whatever lights in on the ground, but everything that's hung, all the power and data, that all goes in beforehand with the rigging crew, which we didn't have on Everything Everywhere All at Once. So it meant my best boy, Michael Beckman, just like never being on set, and like two electricians never being on set, them just always getting the next set ready, which was down the hallway. So that, I think that was the only way we could have accomplished this for all the departments. Cause as soon as you start having these other locations and departments having to get tons of trucks and stuff to get that next location ready, then the budget just starts ballooning at that point. So it was nice to have 30 days in one location and actually get like probably 25 different sets out of that one location. Another thing that the Daniels and the producing team and the DP and production designer thought of beforehand of how do we spread this dollar thin to make this look like it is a huge movie, when in fact it was, you know, still in the low budget realm of, I think, 13 to 15 million.
Yeah, that's amazing. And of course, you know, keeping everything in the exact same location or near really saves on the budget and timing too, right? Because you're not needing to, you know, pick up everything, move it to a new location. So I think that's a very like smart technique that they have going on there. Build everything in one place and do it. And how long did the whole movie take to shoot?
Oh man, I might get this wrong, but I think it was 40 days of principal photography, and then we did like three or four additional. Don't quote me on that. We actually filmed that in 2020. And our last day of principal photography was March 13th of 2020. That was like the day that shit went haywire in the US, you know, with COVID. And we were supposed to film the following Monday, and production asked everybody on the crew, they sent out a survey, like, are you comfortable coming to work on Monday? And all of us were like, no, the world's ending. We just want to like be home. And that last week was actually scary. Like, that was the week that we're on location in downtown LA, and we didn't have many extras for the whole movie except for that last week. So there's a scene where Michelle's on stage and she's like a Chinese opera singer, and we had like 250 extras. And then she's in the lobby as a movie star. We shot that same day, that Friday, 250 extras. And I remember LA City put out a thing saying like, you cannot have more than 300 people in one place. And we were like two people below that. And then March 13th happened that Friday, and then we were shut down. It's like we had the whole movie in the can pretty much, except for some green screen work we had to do. And then we were shut down for 3 months or so. And then we did the additional photography days. And then the movie just sat on the shelf for like a year and a half. I think A24 was waiting for everyone to get back to the theaters because they knew it needed to be like a theatrical experience, a communal experience of people watching it in a room with a bunch of other people. They didn't want it to go direct to streaming. So that was a sort of bummer, like trying to tell people like, oh yeah, I worked on this really cool movie like 2 years ago. And it just sitting somewhere on a server and not being put out yet. So it was super exciting when it actually did come to theaters and did well.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's cool knowing that, like, you know, obviously the crew and the producers had to go through such a hard time, like in life, where it's like, oh, like we don't even know what's going to happen now with the movie. Mm-hmm. And then releasing it years later and being such a success. And, you know, it really puts, you know, perspective in your mind that like in that moment, something bad is happening to you. You don't really know, you know, what's going to happen later on. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's cool hearing that story and seeing where that film went. Just taking it back a little bit, could you explain what exactly does a lighting tech do for people who don't know?
Yeah, so on that movie, I'm working as a gaffer, also known as like the chief lighting technician. So I'm the head of the lighting department, and I report directly to the director of photography, also known as a cinematographer. So they'll hire me, and then they'll hire Key Grip's head of the grip department. So me as a gaffer, my job starts out with talking with the DP as to like what they want to achieve for this movie. So in the case of EAO, it was talking with Larkin about the different multiverses and what was the look of each multiverse, and sort of just getting those creative ideas out of it, the way of understanding how each one of these is going to look. And then after that part, then it's getting into logistics of, well, here is where we are filming this scene, and I think we're going to put this light here, this light there, and scouting. I think we did like a week of scouting for this movie. And then for me, from then on, it's like logistics of getting the crew, getting the equipment, and working with the AD on the schedule to find out what days, what stuff is shooting, and working with my best boy, Mike Beckman, to make sure that we have the right equipment for the right days and the right amount of people for the right days, and going through the schedule with him. And then once all the planning's done and we start shooting, I'm there on set coordinating my crew and the lighting programmer, which was huge on this, Inga is her name, and working with the DP to get all the lights in the place on the floor, and then work with Inga to program the various lighting effects. So my job scales all the way from the creative in the beginning of getting the ideas out there, what we're doing, to logistics, and then finally getting lights in place and programming them to do what they need to do. Well, not me actually doing the programming, but working with the programmer to do it.
Right. Wow. So many like moving parts that you wouldn't really expect, you know, at first when you're usually new in this industry too, you don't expect, oh, we have this huge team that has to, you know, do all these things. Did you always want to be a lighting technician?
So I got into filmmaking from making skate videos in high school, and then like my high school having like an awesome videography department. And so I like took all those classes in high school, and then my teacher was like, you should go to film school. I'm like, sure. I don't really know what I want to do. I'll go to film school. And she was like, I went to Emerson. You should go to Emerson. I'm like, sure, I'll go to Emerson. And so going into Emerson, I'm like, I want to be an editor or I want to be a cinematographer. That was what I sort of figured out when I was 18. And then as soon as I got into film school, Emerson has all these like extracurricular clubs. It's awesome for that. Every weekend, if you wanted to work on someone's film, you could. So I got hired on a student film to like edit something, a music video. And I was like, this is miserable. I never want to be an editor. I'm just like sitting in a room by myself. This is not what I want to do. So I was like, all right, well, DP it is. And then after Emerson College, working as a DP, shooting lots of short films there. At the same time, I was also working as an electrician on films in Boston and working as a gaffer on smaller projects, as well as like being DP on student films. Then I moved to Los Angeles in 2005, where I had to like start over and use my contacts that I met at Emerson to get started. So I was working as a grip, as an electrician, occasionally as a gaffer, and then sometimes like shooting short films as a DP with my friends. So it was several years of that. And then, you know, growing bigger, getting on bigger shoots as a gaffer, electrician. And then I think after a few years, I sort of determined that DP was not really the route I really wanted to go. I started getting more into lighting design. And by that, I mean doing the types of jobs where like the music goes to the lighting. So I've done a few like musicals, broadcast concerts. I do a lot of concert scenes for films. I was like, that's more of the creative route that I actually enjoy, is doing shoots that have lighting that go to music, as opposed to like being a DP on a film that doesn't have that stuff. So I sort of changed routes a little bit there and started going more that direction. At the same time as working as a gaffer, and then eventually not having to work as a set lighting technician, electrician, and just working as a gaffer and lighting designer these days.
That's awesome. Between the time where, you know, you got started in the industry and were actually full time, was that a few years or did it happen like right away?
I think the route that I was going, it was like I was trying to get to be a gaffer and a DP, is you're sort of lucky in that there's lower positions underneath there, such as like working in the grip department as a grip or working in the lighting department as a like as an electrician. And like there's always places that need that work. And it's great training grounds to work as a gaffer, lighting designer, or a DP. Because one, you're like you're setting the lights for them. And two, like you're there. And if you're really paying attention to what you're doing, you can learn a lot of how to light a set or how not to light the set if it's not looking good, you know. And you're getting paid for it and you're working on set. So I think there's a big advantage to those departments that has these, I mean, I wouldn't call them entry level positions because they are very skilled and you do need lots of experience to do them properly. But on smaller shoots, you know, you can hop on as a electrician or possibly a grip, and that's how I learned everything, while at the same time working as gaffer on smaller stuff or even working as a DP for free on stuff. And so working in the lower positions, it was what was paying the bills as I was working my way up in higher positions on smaller jobs.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, like I feel like a lot of people think, hey, we need to get into the industry right away. We need to get paid right away. But they don't understand, you know, the industry is super competitive and you need to have those skills for people to hire you on. And sometimes it takes a few years to do that, right? Especially in this type of industry where it is so competitive. And it's good to start out low on, you know, small projects with friends, right? Student films. And then kind of once you get that experience, you're able to say, hey, I can do this on a bigger set. Because, you know, once you go on a bigger set too, even if you have no skills and then you end up on a bigger set and then you're not able to deliver, people are going to see that. And that's going to kind of, you know, ruin your reputation or contact that you have. And next time they're not going to hire you, right? So it's better to have those skills before even going in there. Would you say you did like years of free work before you actually ended up, you know, getting into some paid work? Because I feel like a lot of people don't know that you need to be a little bit patient with what you're doing in order to do it. And they think, hey, you know, I worked at this job for like 5 months, 6 months, and now I should be doing the big stuff, right?
In school, everything that I was working on for free in school, which was like hundreds of projects, that was of course all for free. But when I was a junior at Emerson, I actually joined IATSE in Boston, and I was actually working on The Departed, the Martin Scorsese film in 2005, as a rigging electrician. So I was pretty lucky that I was able to find paid work, because I feel like my freshman year in college, there were some gaffers that were like seniors that I just went up to them. I'm like, teach me everything I know, I need to know to like work as an electrician. And so, like, my first 2 years in college, like, I learned how to be a competent set lighting technician to just be able to set lights and run cables for people. So, I was early on, I was able to get paid as a set lighting technician. And then that allowed me to work for free or, you know, really reduce rate as a gaffer or as a DP on other projects. And I think that's sort of what you need to find is some source of income to keep living while you're able to not have to take every single job that comes your way, but just take the ones that will be good for your career and the path that you're trying to go down. Because we all need that source of income coming from somewhere to be able to push our career in the direction that we want to go. And for me, it was still being able to work on set, as a set lighting technician. And so I think I got pretty lucky with that I learned those skills of how to set lights early on. So I became marketable and was actually able to join the union IATSE when I was 20 years old.
Right. And for people who don't know IATSE, it's a union that you can join. Do you need any specific hours or anything like that to join that, or you can just apply?
Yeah, it varies where you are and what union you're joining. So at first I joined Local 481, which it was in Boston, and it's for pretty much like most film technicians that work on set in the Boston area. Like most positions are covered under 481. And to join 481, you just needed recommendations. And then to work as a set lighting technician, you had to take an electrical exam. And then when I moved to Los Angeles, it's still IATSE, which is the sort of father union, but it's for lighting, it's Local 728. And so most of the unions in Los Angeles under IATSE, the locals, you have to work 30 days on a union set to join the union, which is sort of funny to say. That's like a catch 22. You can't work on a union set unless you're in the union, and you have to get 30 days on a union set to join the union. So there's sort of two ways to go about that. One is to work on a non-union movie that's in like the $1 million to $3 million budget range, because a lot of times they'll try to start non-union to like save money on not having to pay benefits. And then eventually it will like flip to union because the crew's like, hey, we want healthcare. Please make this a union movie, you know? So once that happens, you're allowed to stay on the movie. If you are on payroll before the movie flipped to union. And so then you can get your 30 days that way. And that's by far the most common way people do it. The other way is if everyone in the union's working, and say I'm gaffer trying to hire people, I can't find anybody that I know in the union, I'd call the union and be like, hey, I need 3 set lighting technicians for tomorrow. And if they're like, we don't have anybody that's available, you can hire non-union. That's another way. So for me, I joined by working on like 2 non-union movies that eventually flipped, and I was able to get my 30 days that way. And I joined IATSE Local 728 in 2007. And I've been in since then. And now actually like I teach classes for them, some training classes, and on the negotiating committees and stuff. So it's been great experience joining 728. Met so many people, and the training classes that they have, there's no other union in the world that has like the amazing training classes that they offer us.
That's awesome. And I know I've heard from, you know, multiple people, some people like the union, some people don't like the union. It's really how you want to go about it. Is that kind of right? Like, I'm sure you have some friends that do like non-union work as well.
Yeah, I think if you're working in film, like you pretty much have to be union. If you're, you know, anything above 3 million or so is going to be a union movie. Commercials, I think the vast majority of like the medium to bigger size commercials are union. There is a lot of non-union commercial work out there. But for me, like I have a wife and 3 kids. I need to provide them healthcare. And if you're not in the union, you're buying your own healthcare, which can be super expensive or cheap and really bad healthcare. And plus, like when I'm working with new companies every single week, I don't know these producers. And most producers I work with are amazing. There's never any issues. But at least every single week working with a new company, if I'm under a union contract, I know they all abide by the same rules. So I don't need to like go and vet out every single company I work with every week. Like they sign the union contract. I know if there were any issues, which there never really are, that I could call my union and they can help us out with that situation. And then of course the training side of it is great. And just the camaraderie of all the members. So for me, the union's been like a huge positive. And in the US where we don't have free healthcare, you know what, until production companies offer health insurance aside, like it's really the only way to get good healthcare working as a freelancer, besides paying into like super expensive plans.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I wanted to ask if you could go back to when you were 18 and give yourself a piece of advice, what would that advice be?
I think I was very rigid in my ideas when I was 18, you know, not just like for cinematography and my career, but in life. I think I wasn't like very open to new ideas. And since then, probably took a while until I like started dating my wife, and I think I like chilled out a little bit, that things changed. But in terms of just like cinematography, you know, like you read all these books on lighting and it's like, this is how you have to light. You have a key light, a backlight, and a fill light. And you're like, okay, well, let's make sure every single setup we have all of those. And they sort of like give you these rules of how to light and how to make an image look good. And I feel like for many years, I was like, all right, let's follow these rules. Like, I can look at an image and I could be like, oh, that image looks really good, but not really understand why it looks good or why it's serving its purpose. And I think once you can look at an image and realize why that image is working, then you don't really need to follow the rules. You can sort of go around the path that you want. And working for the DP, Larkin Seipel, who is the DP of Everything Everywhere All at Once, Swiss Army Man, we actually like went to college together. I think I learned a lot from him of like breaking the rules of lighting and not lighting traditionally to make the image work. Because he lights way differently than any other DP that I work as a gaffer for. And I think at first I was teaching him a little bit about lighting, and then there was like a flip one day and he just started doing all this really unconventional stuff. And I've, you know, every time I work with him, I see something new, he tries something new, and I learn something from him, because he's never been the one to like follow these rigid rules. And I think working with him helped break me from that and come up with more creative ideas on how to light a set or how to just like make the image. I wouldn't even say look good, because in Everything Everywhere All at Once, in all of Larkin's work, he's not one of those DPs that like tries to make the image always look beautiful. He's the type of DP that's trying to serve the story, which in one case it might make the actress like not look as beautiful as maybe she should be for this, but it's serving the purpose of the story. And that's definitely another thing that I've learned a lot from him and from watching movies with different DPs. That, and I think that's changed in cinematography in the past 10 years, is people aren't as worried about making beautiful looking images, just making images that serve the purpose of the story.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. I think that was like very well answered. I think a lot of people will learn a lot from that. What's your biggest failure? And what did you learn from it?
Biggest failure. There's been so many. I'm trying to think. But, I mean, I don't think I've had a big failure. Lots of little failures. You know, you learn. I think the hardest part of being any department head, you know, me being the head of the lighting department and then all the other department heads, is working with production and working with your budget. And like the side of being a manager is very difficult, because it's like you on smaller jobs, like you learn how to light, you learn how to use the equipment. But when you start getting to bigger jobs, like when I was doing Spider-Man or Gaslit, you know, which are 100 million plus, like I'm just a manager, you know, steering this giant ship in the right direction. And so then you're dealing with a lot of money, and it's trying to not make really expensive mistakes. I think when I was prepping the second Spider-Man, I think it was Spider-Man Far From Home, we did the LA portion of that. We have the package that like hangs up in the ceiling and the stages. So that's usually like one PO, one purchase order. And then we have like the package for each stage. And then I don't think I told the producer that, like, oh yeah, there's like one more package coming your way that you need to earmark for the budget, the floor package. So like the lights that we bring in for every single shot, depending on the shot. And it came out to 250,000, which like in the eyes of like 100 million, like that's probably not that much, but the producer came over and was like, what is this? I'm like, that's the floor package, didn't I tell you like that was coming? She's like, I am not paying $250,000 for this that I wasn't expecting. I'm like, oh man, you definitely have a point. Like and I'm thinking to myself, like, oh, I didn't make it clear that like that wasn't all of the lighting. So yeah, I think the biggest mistakes I've made are just learning to be like a good manager as opposed to just understanding the technicalities of lighting and what are like the different processes that you need as a department head to manage the money in your department and also be like a good leader to your crew in keeping the crew morale up. And that's a thing I've definitely learned a lot over the past 10 years is how to be a good leader. And that's another skill that like you don't learn until you start getting into bigger stuff, because on smaller movies, I have like two, three people in my department, but when I do bigger movies, it's sometimes up to like 40 to 50 people. And so the skills you need to manage a department that big is much different than the skills you need to manage a department of two or three. And I'm still learning that. And now I'm getting into like a lot of the books on like being a leader and you know, having employees underneath you that I never thought would be a part of filmmaking. But you know, it is. And I always enjoy learning new stuff, and I've moved on from the technical stuff and now starting to get into that part of the business of trying to get better at that.
Very cool. And I think this kind of leads into the next question, which is like, in your opinion, what is the most important strength someone would need to be successful within your industry? And I know you said like leadership at a obviously like higher skill. But what if someone's getting like new started, you know, in the industry, they want to get their foot in the door. Like what would you say would be there? And then maybe we could go into, you know, where you are as well. And is it also leadership plus more, or would you say it's leadership?
Yeah, I think the number one skill to have in the film industry and most industries is be enjoyable to work with. You know, like that's easy to learn. You know, there's plenty of technicians that I've hired that are great technicians, but like I don't really want them around. You know, like they're not enjoyable to work with. So that's like the number one easy skill before you're getting into any position, I think, in the film industry is be enjoyable to work with, have someone that would want to hang out with you know. And then beyond that, it's always keep learning. Like I'm still every day on set, there's something new that I'm learning because I try to pay attention to what all of the departments are doing. Or like once a setup's done, like looking at the monitor, be like, oh, what could I have done to make this look better? Or how could I have accomplished this setup in a more efficient way, either using less equipment, the process we use to create this setup? So I think that's the number two thing is always look to how could you have done things better, and always analyzing your own work and quietly analyze the work of other people. You know, keep it to yourself, but like, okay, what did this DP do that like if I was DPing this, I could have done differently. And I wouldn't go say that to the DP, but you know, re realizing how you can keep getting better and keep moving on, because it's not an industry where you just like you learn your job and you're done. Like it's a very complex job of using your artistry with the technical, and then on top of that, on bigger stuff, with being a manager, you're combining all three of those skills to accomplish what you need to so that the camera's recording the scene how you want it to be recorded within the budget and the people on your crew are happy. So I'm every day for me on set is trying to learn something new or how to do something better.
That's awesome. I feel like a lot of people will get bigger in their industry and then stop learning. It's good that you're still, you know, trying to learn and see how you can do it better. And of course, you're always getting challenged as well, right, in your industry. Like now you're dealing with huge budgets, and it's like if you forget to give an order or, you know, you forget something, it makes a huge difference like within it. So, you know, you always want to be at your best as well. And
And
to the
with,
point, yeah, go ahead.
oh, with lighting, it's a little different now too, because the shift to LED and like every month there's a new light out it might be crap, or it could like completely revolutionize how we light sets. So especially now, if you're not keeping up with it, you're left way behind, because everyone wants to shoot with the newest equipment that makes things most efficient, not just like the DP needs a gaffer that can accomplish that. And then production is realizing that we are able to light way faster and our setups are going way faster than they ever were because of lighting consoles and LEDs. And so if you're not every week like looking on Instagram or on trade show reports, then you're left behind in lighting right now. It's just changing so fast.
Yeah, it's amazing. I think we're very blessed to live like where we are now, because our cameras are just getting smaller and easier to use, right? And then as same with lighting as well, right? You're able to do so much for such lighterness too, right? So it's amazing. Like, it's amazing how much faster we're able to move sets that we weren't able to before. And of course that, you know, comes back to saving on budget, right? At the end of the day, so more films are
shooting faster,
it's gonna be easier for you. Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Getting more shots in the day. And it's funny, when I started, it was like there was tungsten, HMI, and KinoFlow. Like, that was it. And that was like the first 10 years of my career. And now the second 10 years of my career, it's completely changed. I would feel so bad for someone like starting in lighting right now, because the amount of information that you need to get started is so huge. When I started, it was like, you need to understand how to run cables, calculate amperage, and like, here are the 20 lights you might use. Now it's like, here are the 5,000 lights available to you. You don't need to understand power as much, but like, you need to understand network infrastructure, how to create Ethernet networks and that. So, you know, different skill sets.
Is there any favorite lights that you use right now?
Yeah, I think my go-to stuff, I use a lot of the digital Sputniks, the not the Voyagers, but the old ones. Light Max Spectrums, I use a lot. All of the Astera stuff, Astera Titans. My new like favorite one is the DMG Roscoe Dash. It's only like the size of a cell phone, and it has wireless power and wireless data built in. So we use those a lot. But yeah, and then I use a lot of moving lights too, which is a new thing of like the past 5 years. Moving lights, you typically see them used in concerts, you know, being able to like wiggle and do ballyhoos and all that. But we use them a lot in film and commercials now as just like a static light that we can position remotely and zoom in and zoom out. And so that's been a really cool thing, to be able to have one light that can do 10 different things, as opposed to just having 10 lights that we need set lighting technicians on scissor lists to adjust. We can just hang 5 lights, and every single setup, those 5 lights can do something else, because we're able to pan and tilt them remotely using the lighting console instead of having to get ladders or scissor lifts up in the ceiling.
Beautiful. I just want to go back to one of the points you made before the whole got into lighting, which was, you know, just being pleasant to work with people like on set. I feel like even on our sets, like when we're hiring a bunch of people to work on a set, we're always looking for people who are very like fun to work with, upbeat, right? And get things done quickly and are able to, you know, kind of communicate with our client and be professional too. I think that's huge, like within the industry, and probably like one of the biggest things that gets you back in, right? Is being able to build those connections. How do you these days get most of your jobs, and how did you in the past, like how did you get them in the past? And I'm sure nowadays, like it's, you know, enough people that they're just hiring you on, you've done enough work, but back in the day when you were getting started, how would you get most of your jobs?
Getting started, my network was built from people I met at film school at Emerson College. And just, you know, like when you're a freshman, you like go right up to the senior and you're like, I want to work on your student film this weekend. And then like that senior graduates and they have like a 3-year head start in the industry. And then there's just, you graduate college, you reach out to that senior, be like, hey, can I work on your film this weekend? And so to me, film school was huge and influence of getting my career started because of the people that I met there. And actually, like Larkin, the DP I work with mainly these days, I actually met him in college. He was a year below me. And then Larkin met the Daniels, the directors of EAO, in college. And so for me, film starting was really the jump start to my career through the people I met there. And then it's pretty much that just expanding once you start getting into the industry. Everyone I get hired from is either someone I've worked with previously or a recommendation from someone I've worked with previously. So probably 75% of my jobs I get hired for, I'm hired by the DP. Occasionally it's the producer, director, occasionally production designer will recommend me. But most of the time it's the DP. And at this point, you know, the amount of DPs I worked with is pretty large. So they'll call me again. Or if none of their normal gaffers or lighting designers are available, they'll ask their normal gaffer, or they'll ask someone else, like, hey, I need a gaffer. And they'll be like, oh, Matt Ardeen, I just worked with him. He was great to work with. So it's all through recommendations, which goes back to what we were just talking about. Like, if you're not enjoyable to work with, like, no one's going to recommend you. and so I think anything in the film industry is just building out your network, meeting more and more people, letting people know when you're available, and also letting people know what your career goals are. You know, this is where you're currently working and this is where you want to be. And I have a lot of people on my crew that work as set lighting technicians that want to work as gaffers or DPs. And, you know, I want to make sure that I know that that's where they're trying to go. So when we're done with the lighting setup, I can explain to them like, oh, this light's here because of this reason. This light's here because of this reason. We made this daylight balance and this 3200 balance because of this. So trying to teach them so that they can make their upward trajectory too.
That's awesome. What are you working on currently? Is there something you're working on?
Right now, last year, I did a TV show called Gaslit. It was 105 days of filming, and it was an awesome show to work on. It was like the first full TV show I ever worked on. And as far as like TV goes, it was great to work with. Every department was great. Production was awesome to work with. We had a lot of fun. But at the end of 105 days, you're like, this is a lot. And I was like, next year, so 2022, I'm sticking to like short form stuff. So this year has been mainly commercials. I broadcast concerts for iHeartRadio. Actually, right after this, I'm going to a load-in for a concert next week for iHeartRadio, the K-pop band Monsta X. So we do like a five-camera live broadcast, and then they also do an edit later. And then this year, I also fit in a lighting designer job for the TV show Daisy Jones and the Six, where it was pretty cool. I got to recreate a bunch of concerts from 1977. Which I wasn't even born in. I was born in 1984. So I had to like do a bunch of research of what concerts looked like back then. And then I think next year, it's not confirmed yet, but I'm going to be doing a movie for probably like four months, partially in New York City and then mostly in Los Angeles. So I have a wife and three kids, so I try not to take movies and TVs too much, because you just like, you don't see your family at all if you're working that constantly, especially if you're out of town. Whereas commercials like gives me the lifestyle to have days off in the week to drive the kids to school, pick them up, make the soccer games and all that. So that's been this year for me. And then I think next year I'll do that 4 month movie and then I'll go back to commercials for the rest of the year. Just because I like to have a lot of free time to myself to spend with my family. I like skating a lot. I like running in the mountains a lot. And so commercials has provided me that lifestyle to have days off to be able to do stuff in life and not just in career.
Yeah, of course. And typically with movies and shows too, you're shooting for so long periods of time every day, right? 12, 14, 16 hour days. So you don't really get to do much with your life between those months. So it's really hard, you know, for people to constantly be shooting a show or constantly shooting a movie and then have a life as well. So commercials does give you that, you know, time off where you're able to still make some money, right? And be able to do, you know, what you want to do in life. And I think we talked about this in our last podcast too, about like burning out, right? Where, you know, people think they can constantly be working all the time, but then you have that burnout and then, you know, you're not able to do anything. Have you ever had a burnout or have you been?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I'm funny. Like I'll complain to my crew, like, man, we just did five jobs in a row that were like really boring and really easy. Like we need a real ass kicker. Then like you'll get like three ass kickers in a row and then you're like, okay, I'm burnt out now. Like those were massive jobs where like we're installing thousands of lights in a day and tons of coordination and like everything's riding on me, and then you're like, okay, I need some time off, and then I'm ready to get back to the easy jobs. For me this year, that was at Daisy Jones and the Six TV show. Was my ass kicker for the year, where it was like load in 1,000 lights in a course of a week, and then a tornado came by, ripped off the roof, and we had to like take it all down and put it all back up. And then after that job, I'm like, okay, well, that was a fun one. I got my ass kicker out of the way. Time to go back to some easy jobs.
That's awesome. Anything you want to add?
No, I think we went over a bunch of great topics without getting too technical. You know, sometimes we dive down that technical route, which I know alienates some of the audience. So I'm glad we were able to talk broadly about this. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate your time. And, you know, of course, everyone else is going to appreciate your time as well. And I love how, you know, we're going to have this podcast forever for people to kind of like look back on, new people coming into the industry as well. So I really appreciate you doing that. For people who want to find you or, you know, maybe reach out for a question or two or not, where can they find you? And are they able to reach out? Like, obviously, you know, you don't have that much time on your hands. So if people want to follow you, just give them that link and then, you know, let them know if they want to reach out, they can or not.
Yeah. My Instagram is just Matt Ardeen. I do have a website, mattardeen.com. I got to work on that. That's been on the back burner of, you know, what happens is all these commercials, companies start taking them down. They're like, oh, that's from 2018. We're going to remove that from the internet. And so like, it's all these broken links on my website that I got to fix. But I've been keeping up my Instagram lately. And yeah, feel free to DM me on Instagram. If people have like specific questions about jobs, those are always great to answer. In terms of like career path thing, that's always the thing that's more difficult. I get like the hire me DMs all the time, which I enjoy. I'm not against it. I'm just in the position right now where like it's difficult to hire people that aren't in the union because every job I do is pretty much union. But no, any DMs is welcome on Instagram. Feel free.
That's awesome. And for people who are listening online, that's Matt Ardeen, MattArdine on Instagram. Mm-hmm. Awesome, Matt. I really appreciate you, man. Like great talking to you. So many good things we went over. I think people will learn a lot.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, brother. Cheers. Take care. If you ever need anything, let us know.
Will do.